Hi, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Part 8 of Great Decisions of the 20th Century. Tonight, the drama of 1948 to declare a state, sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah Ben Rav Aryeh Leib. By 1947, the British had tired of war. In fact, they had tired of being an empire. They just didn't know that yet. And they began to look for a way out of their Middle East morass. Lives were being lost. And there was tremendous pressure back home about that. British interests across the region were being harmed. And the embarrassment wrought to the British by their internment of Jewish refugees and their denial of Jewish immigration was intense. At their urging, the United Nations formed UNSCOP, United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, which began its deliberations in May 1947. They met with Jews. Jews referenced the support they gave the Allies during World War II, as opposed to the Arabs, who by and large were pro-Nazi, and the historic connection of the Jewish people, I quote, which gave to mankind spiritual and ethical values, inspiring human personalities, and sacred texts, which are your treasured possessions. Based on that, they asked for the land of Israel. The Arabs demanded that, I quote, they not suffer for the crimes of Hitler, essentially denying any intrinsic Jewish connection, Jewish attachment to the land of Israel, a position from which they have not really deviated for more than six decades. UNSCOP visited Israel. They were there when the Exodus docked and was turned away. Some of their members were brought to Haifa to witness the brutal treatment of the passengers, and it worked. Abba Ibn, a young Abba Ibn, who accompanied them, wrote that they were pale with shock, seeing these refugees, seeing their treatment as they arrived in the land of Israel. David Ben-Gurion addressed the committee on July 4th, underscoring the, I quote, unbroken tie between our people and our land, and the defenselessness of the Jews throughout the ages, even the despair of many. He continued, but the Jewish people as a whole did not give way, did not despair, or renounce its hope and faith in a better future, national as well as universal. What was missing, of course, from his and other appeals was God and Torah and Jewish destiny. The resort to the Holocaust on the one hand and history on the other, that Jews had once lived there, persuaded only the already persuaded, but not the Arabs or their supporters. The Arabs were not responsible for the Holocaust, and many nations had moved on from their lands without retaining a two-millennia-year-old claim. But these formulaic arguments still endure with ever-decreasing persuasiveness. The claim was not completely ignored, although in a jocular manner, Weizmann asked, why here? Why not some other land? And he answered, I could, if I wished to be facetious, say it was not our responsibility. It was the responsibility of Moses, who acted from divine inspiration. He might have brought us to the United States, not to this part of the world. So he might have brought us to the Mississippi, not to Jordan, but he chose to stop here. It's also not such a persuasive argument. Some UNSCOP members met with the Haganah to inquire as to their capacity to withstand an Arab attack and were reassured. While there, the Irgun hanged two British Army sergeants, as we discussed last week, in retaliation for the execution of three Irgunists in Akko prison. The outraged British public demanded that the troops be brought home. UNSCOP recommended the partition of the land into two states, one Jewish, one Arab. The Arab rejected the very proposal, milchatchila. The partition plan was deliberated and brought to a vote November 29, 1947, in the General Assembly. The Soviet Union enthusiastically endorsed partition. Andrei Gromyko, the ambassador at the time, later longtime foreign minister, said, as a result of the war, the Jews as a people have suffered more than any other people. They are striving to create a state of their own, and it would be unjust to deny them that right. Those were the Soviets. In fact, they never wavered in their support of a Jewish state, unlike most of the Allies during this process. Throughout the process, despite Stalin's hatred of Jews, He anticipated another socialist state that would be sympathetic to the Soviet Union. He didn't realize that Ben-Gurion was a socialist, but a Western-oriented socialist. He would later turn to the West, angering Stalin and souring relations for decades. By a vote of 33-13 with 10 abstentions, either two-thirds of 56 nations, the partition resolution passed. The U.S. voted in favor, so did Poland. Britain abstained, the Arab states and Greece and India and Afghanistan, if you really want to know, voted against. Great joy erupted across the Jewish world. Ben-Gurion, for some reason then vacationing, awakened at a hotel on the Dead Sea, saw the rejoicing, and later wrote, "That night, crowds danced in the streets. I could not dance. I knew that we faced war, and that in it we would lose the best of our youth." He said to a colleague, "That night I was like an ovel at a simcha." We'll pause now for a few moments to look at a few selections again from the Destiny Foundation, whom I thank, Rabbi Wein, for their generosity in letting me use it. Three different pieces, around 8 minutes, just to give us a flavor of what's going on at the time. It's all working this week. It's all working.
President Truman began to support the creation of a Jewish state, but was bitterly opposed by Secretary of State George Marshall and Secretary of Defense James Forrestal. Initially, President Truman refused the entreaties of an aged and ailing Chaim Weizmann to meet with him. But at this point in time, divine providence revealed itself. Years earlier, President Truman had been in partnership in a haberdashery store in Kansas City, Missouri, with a man named Eddie Jacobson, who had remained his lifelong friend. Zionist leaders approached Jacobson to prevail upon Truman to talk with Weizmann.
The Zionists contact Jacobson and basically persuade him, "You're the only man who can get to Truman now. This is the 12th hour. You've got to persuade him to receive Weizmann, and Weizmann will do the rest." Jacobson goes to Truman, and he gets nowhere. The minute he walks in, Truman says, "Eddie, before we go further, I don't want to hear a word about Zionism." He's tongue-tied. What can he say? That was the whole mission. Goes around, skating around, gets nowhere. He's about to go when this very simple man, Eddie Jacobson, looking outside the White House window, Lafayette Square Park, there's a statue of Andrew Jackson there. Says, "Harry, I know that Andy Jackson has always been your hero. Well, Chaim Weizmann has always been my hero. You've got to see him." And Truman's sputtering. He says, "You son of a bitch, I'll see him, but don't tell anyone." Just straight out, expletives and all. And Jacobson goes out, reports to his people. The word gets to Weizmann, and he goes to see Truman. That meeting has never been written down, but Truman basically says to Weizmann, "If you declare a Jewish state, I will back you."
Declaring a Jewish state was one thing. Defining the nature of that Jewish state was something entirely different. As usual, throughout our history, we Jews have always argued, especially over the issue of Jewish identity, how we define ourselves.
The Declaration of Independence itself is a reflection of the tensions between the secular and religious camp.
And that's always plagued Zionism.
For example, does one mention God's name in the Declaration of Independence?
Secularists and extreme ones such as Yitzhak Rosenbaum of the Jewish Agency wanted to have no mention whatsoever. The religious insisted, "How can you have a Jewish state in a declaration without the name of God mentioned?" The compromise was Tzur Yisrael, the Rock of Israel, for religious Jews that clearly meant God. We say it in our prayers, Tzur Yisrael, before the Amidah of the Tfilah of every day. On the other hand, for secularists, that could mean anything. And that was purposely done, if you will, to paper up the differences between the religious and the secular.
On the afternoon of May 14th, the British finally left Palestine after 30 years of mandatory rule.
Amidst the increasing violence and chaos of the collapsing Palestinian society around them, and in the face of the threat of Arab invasion from other countries, the Executive Committee of the Jewish Agency voted in favor of the establishment of a Jewish state. David Ben-Gurion declared independence immediately, naming the new state Israel.
על הקמת מדינה יהודית בארץ ישראל. זאת מדינת ישראל.
ברוך אתה אדוני אלוהינו מלך העולם, שחיינו וזימנו ויהיינו לזמנם הזה.
The date of Friday, May 14, 1948, the eve of the Sabbath, was a turning point in Jewish history. For the first time in 2,000 years, the Jews regained sovereignty over their ancient homeland. 11 minutes after Ben-Gurion's declaration, President Truman was the first world leader on behalf of the United States of America to officially recognize the new state of Israel.
The United States recognizes the provisional government as the de facto authority of the new state of Israel.
Was announced by loudspeaker in the street, you know, and everybody who could move, who could walk, went, and together we were dancing in the street and thanking us that we had the people, because we were to become again a nation. And for us, survivors, for sure it meant a lot that we had. Can be in our country and we won't be caught again dirty too.
For the survivors of the Holocaust, waiting in the BP camps in Europe and the internment camps in Cyprus, this moment, which they had prayed and suffered for so long, was finally over.
All right. I can watch the rest of it also. It's very interesting. It's always very moving to see that. Yes?
One of those men was Rabbi Wine.
The Rabbi Wine, correct.
Who is the other one?
Pankauer. Monty Pankauer, a history professor. So let's just flesh out some of the facts. I want to correct also one or two things that I don't think are correct. I'll let you know when. Ben-Gurion knew that the war would be difficult because the Jewish Agency executive, of which he was the chairman, had at his request more than a year earlier made him the quasi-minister of defense. So Ben-Gurion had very little military training or knowledge, but in the previous years he immersed himself in the study of tactics, logistics, armaments, and the conduct of war, and he extensively interviewed Haganah officers. They had already begun secret arms procurements. The Haganah had about 40,000 troops, but that was a misleading figure. We're talking now in the fall of 1947. Of the 40,000, only 2,100, the Palmach, were fully mobilized and ready to fight. The Jews were seriously shorthanded in terms of manpower and weaponry. In the DP camps, men under internment were being trained with wooden rifles in the anticipation at some point they'd make it to the land of Israel. Milchemet HaShichrur, the War of Independence, really began right after partition. Within the partition resolution was adopted within days. And Ben-Gurion realized that, however, the resolution divided the land of Israel, and as you know, Israel received pathetically small and indefensible territory, slivers along the coast, part of the Galil, most of the Negev, no Yerushalayim. However small it was, it would have to be defended by force. And the ultimate borders would be determined not by the UN, but by the fighting. The subtext of the half year from the UN resolution to Yom HaTzimut and the fear and hesitation to declare a state always boiled down to one issue, however we phrase it. Could the Jews defend themselves? Could they hold off the Arab armies that really were unencumbered by any arms embargo or moral qualms? Could the Jewish community avert a disaster? Were they marching into another Holocaust? Could they maintain international support at the same time they sought the establishment of a Jewish state? None of those were idle fears. And if the people didn't know that war was coming, only Ben-Gurion and a few others knew how dire the military situation really was. And add to that burden, right after Partition Day, pogroms broke out across the Arab world. In Aden, in Yemen, 82 Jews were massacred on December 9th. In Libya, 130 Jews were killed. In Lebanon and Egypt, shuls were ransacked, houses looted, and this is long before independence. This is still December 1947. In Israel itself, there was an immediate surge of Arab terror, shootings, bombings, arson. The Irgun and Lehi responded in kind, blowing up an Arab cafe, blowing up an Arab guard post at Shar Yafo. The old city was already under siege, with heavy fighting a daily routine. And the war began. Caesarea Caesarea was captured by the Haganah in February. Caesarea was Jewish-owned land that had been leased to the Arabs. The Arabs fled. Meanwhile, the British decided to leave on a date certain, May 15, 1948. Much would happen before then, and the British, angered at the loss already in a year and a half of 127 soldiers killed by Jewish forces and hundreds more wounded, mainly as a result of Irgun and Lehi operations, and the British worried also about the potential souring of relations between Britain and the Arab world and their oil, were blatantly uncooperative with the Jewish leadership, still denying at this late stage Jewish immigration, still preventing them from importing weapons, still preventing them from organizing an army, even denying the Jewish agency access to land registry deeds so they would know after statehood who owns what, denying them knowledge of where supplies of food and fuel were kept. The British even openly tried to prevent UN officials from visiting until May 1st, but when they came anyway, the British refused to assist them. Their role had been critical, but they were soon outflanked, and the influence of another nation flexing its muscles after World War II increased greatly, and that was the United States. Now, the American role in the creation of Israel was complicated, contentious, equivocal, and in the end, probably, but not necessarily, indispensable. I wrote a paper on this, a thesis in college, a very long paper on America's role in the creation of Israel. If only I had to remember what I had written or could find it, I'd be in a better position. But nonetheless, it's a fascinating story. It's not as linear as we make it seem. Truman had pushed the British by recommending in October 1946 the immediate immigration of 100,000 Jewish refugees. The British protested. They said openly it's because congressional elections were just a month away, November 46. It's the first time the people would be able to vote after Roosevelt had died, and that's why Truman did it. But nonetheless, it was at that point they realized with the U.S. turning, they had no future in the land of Israel. But nothing was smooth, and the U.S. already then played a double game in the Middle East. So for example, 2 months before he died in April 1945, FDR met with King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, the father of the Saudi dynasty, he of the 22 wives and 45 sons, one of whom is still the king. They met at the Suez on the ship. Roosevelt had sailed there after Yalta. Now, we don't often think of this, but oil was only discovered in Saudi Arabia in 1938 by an American company, and the U.S. didn't even take a formal interest in Arabia until 1943. The area of the world meant nothing to everyone. But after that, access to oil was everything. Ibn Saud was a rabid Jew hater who felt that the Holocaust survivors should be compensated with German land, not Arab land. He wrote to Roosevelt, "The Arabs and Jews could never cooperate, neither in Palestine nor in any other country. The Arabs would choose to die rather than yield their land to the Jews." That was 1943, and nothing much has changed. Interestingly, he said they could get along with the Middle Eastern Jews, whom they dominated for so many centuries. But he said the European Jews brought instability to the Muslim world because of what he called their superior skills and culture. FDR told Ibn Saud that he would make no change in America's basic policy in Palestine without full and prior consultation with both Jews and Arabs. And he later wrote to Ibn Saud a letter in which he stated, I quote, "I will not undertake in my role as head of the executive branch in this administration any action likely to be hostile to the Arab people." Ibn Saud understood this as a firm commitment of the American government and not simply as a personal promise of Roosevelt. You can really darshan it both ways. And so he was outraged when Truman supported partition and recognized the Jewish state. Now, Harry Truman is a very complicated person. Yotza Hefsedo Bischoro. The truth is, he was a creature of his times and the prejudices of his times. He personally disliked Jews. We saw the friendship that he had with Eddie Jacobson, but it was more a business partnership. Jacobson once said that he never entered the home, the Truman home, for social reasons, because Bess would never let a Jew cross the threshold of her home, Bess being Harry Truman's wife. So he was a person who just embodied the cultural mores, the social mores of his time. But Truman, above all, was a decent and a fair-minded person. And if at first glance he judged you based on the group you were part of, when he got to know a person, he dealt with individuals much differently. So, for example, Truman was a racist also. If you just read his oral history, you get the flavor of that. But fairness decreed that the U.S. military be integrated, and so he did it over great opposition. He respected Jacobson because when their haberdashery business went bankrupt, he and Jacobson labored for years to ensure that every creditor, but every creditor, would be paid back every nickel. And ultimately, integrity mattered to Truman far more than did race or religion. Truman was sympathetic to the notion of a Jewish state, like most Bible-believing Christians are, but he was always mindful of the fact that FDR had been president for so long that Truman was considered by FDR's staff and successors an interloper, an intellectual lightweight, an accidental president who should leave matters of state to the professionals. Indeed, the State Department and the newly created Defense Department were hotbeds of pro-Arabism. State almost always, until today, and defense, it depends on who's in office. I guess we'll know soon enough what changes in defense are coming. The State Department feared the loss of Arab oil and influence in the region, and so actively opposed partition, and then actively opposed independence. Until partition, the Secretary of State, the former Chief of Staff during the war, George Marshall, who's an American hero, had kept his reservations about statehood private. After the partition resolution was adopted, he would not be so reticent. Now, several other forces were at play here. The American Jewish community became much more assertive after the Holocaust. Remember, a few weeks back we discussed the era before the Holocaust and the silence of American Jewry. In a sense, after the war, American Jews did penance and were very active. They raised in a short time $100 million for European refugee aid. It's an enormous sum, even today, but then nothing approaching that had ever been raised by anyone for any cause, $100 million. And pro-Zionists like Stephen Wise and Abba Hillel Silver, both were former rabbis, leaped to the forefront of American Jewish life. Now note, they were still the exceptions amongst Reform Jewry. The Reform Rabbinate, the Reform leadership, by and large, were anti-Zionist through the Declaration of the State and did not support a declaration of statehood. They wanted it to be deferred, as we'll discuss in another context. Also, for the first time in American history, the Jewish vote became more prominent and worthy of being courted. Today it's really a chimera. Only Jews and Jew haters speak of the Jewish road, but in numbers it's not real, and the homogeneity of the Jewish road really dilutes its influence. But that's for another time. Truman's endorsement of the 100,000 new immigrants was released right before the elections, and 1948 itself was an election year in which Truman was fighting an uphill battle against several candidates, including Democratic opponents even in the general election, and Strom Thurmond and Henry Wallace, and their Republican opponent, Thomas E. Dewey. So Truman really defeated three other candidates, credible candidates, to win. More than once, Truman would be accused of playing politics with American interests in the Middle East, although it would be unfair to him to assert that such considerations were primary. But Truman would say and write quite repeatedly and vehemently that he grew to despise the American Zionists, who pressured him relentlessly, questioning their loyalty and provoking in him outrageous anti-Jewish remarks. It was a struggle to the end. Two non-Jews, there are more, but two especially, two non-Jews stand out in their support for Israel and their persuasion of Truman, like Harvona, Zechur Latov, David K. Niles, and Clark Clifford. Both were advisors to the president, both were unyielding in their support of the Jewish state, and both were marvelous fighters in the internal intrigue taking place. Now, even before the partition resolution, states had floated a plan that called for a unitary state in Palestine under UN trusteeship. That plan was shot down, but it would be resurrected several times in the spring of 1948. Independence would not be won easily. The plan was that the British would be gone, but they'd be replaced by the UN. And the UN would just kick the can down the road until some appropriate solution could be found, if it could ever be found. Part of the impetus for that, the State Department plan, was contempt for the Jews. Part was the growing realization that partition could not be implemented without force, military force, and that since the Jews could not defend themselves, it was widely held to be true, they had no real army, very few weapons, little training. Over 1,000 Jews had already been killed since partition from November to April. The only way to enforce partition, it was felt, would be through the presence of U.S. troops, and after World War II, there was no appetite for that. In February, despite the fact that the U.S. had supported partition in November, in February 1948, George Marshall adopted the trusteeship plan, and the American ambassador to the U.N., Warren Austin, broached this plan before the U.N. Security Council in late February, essentially preempting statehood, trying to avert a catastrophe when the British left. Truman wavered, and it was at that point, in March 1948, that clip we saw of the meeting with Eddie Jacobson took place. Chaim Weizmann sought a meeting with Truman to reaffirm America's support for a Jewish state and against the trusteeship scheme hatched by the State Department. But Truman refused to see Weizmann or any other Jew, and then you saw the story. Jacobson came, he came on condition that he not mention Israel or Zionism, and you know, Truman regularly entertained his old friends. He was really an earthy individual. Almost every day he'd bring friends in to play cards and drink whiskey with him in the Oval Office. They chatted, and then Jacobson said, and in fact it wasn't the statue of Jackson in Lafayette Square, you know, the Oval Office does not have a window facing Lafayette Square. Truman had a bust in his office of Andrew Jackson, because Andrew Jackson was his hero among presidents, and that's when Jackson cradled his bust and said that, like, Jackson is your hero, Weizmann is mine. And Weizmann, he said, he came all the way here to see you, and he's an old man, he's a sick man, you saw in the picture, he's almost blind at this time, and he was in and out of American hospitals. He came all this way, you won't even see him. What kind of person are you? And Truman exploded, screaming and cursing, and Jacobson yelled back, and Truman said, I'll clean it up, but said on the screen, okay, you bald-headed SOB, you win, I'll see Weizmann. And Truman saw Weizmann March 18th and assured him of his support for a Jewish state. Like I said, nothing was simple. The very next day, in the United Nations, March 19th, Warren Austin recommended to the Security Council that partition be suspended and a trusteeship established. Truman was livid. State had defied him, essentially enunciating American policy that differed from that of the president, defying the president. Whether it was unintentionally or unintentionally is still debatable. And worse, from Truman's perspective, he said Jacobson and Weizmann would construe him to be a liar. He called Jacobson and Clifford. They reached out to Weizmann, who was in and out of hospitals, and Weizmann said he assumed that Truman was unaware of what would transpire at the UN, and he trusted him. Also behind the betrayal, by the way, was a figure that would become more prominent 20 years later, the state's representative at the UN, Dean Rusk. He'd become the Secretary of State under the Johnson administration and was in that post during the Six-Day War. So he, in fact, pushed the trusteeship scheme as well. The UN leadership was also dismayed by the seeming change in the American position because it sought to work undermine. Here it's declared for partition, two states. Its reputation diminished at a time UN was barely 2 years old. The trusteeship option, right after Truman got involved, rebuking state, was muted. But in fact, it would remain viable until Yom HaTzmaut and the cause of much anguish and soul searching. That and one other option presented itself as well, a truce that would remain in effect as long as neither party claimed an independent state. Austin proposes to the UN on April 1st, truce and a UN special session. Both Arabs and Jews rejected it, but in fact it was approved. Security Council Resolution 46, April 17th, 1948, that I have in front of me, that called, among other things, for a cessation of all military activities, refraining from bringing any arms into the country, and especially refrain pending further consideration of the future government of Palestine by the General Assembly from any political activity which might prejudice the rights, claims, or position of either community. Does that mean that the Jews had to renounce a declaration of statehood? It's probably what the UN meant. The resolution passed unanimously. Nonetheless, it was never enforced. As the U.S. was wavering, the situation on the ground in Israel was deteriorating. In January, we know infamously, 35 Haganah soldiers were massacred attempting to resupply Gush Etzion, later memorialized in the kibbutz Netiv HaLamed Hay. In February, Arab car bombs blew up the Palestine post office in Yerushalayim, the market on Ben Yehuda, even the Jewish Agency building. Nothing was safe, and no one was safe. Several different Arab armies and gangs launched constant attacks on Jewish settlements and civilians. Yerushalayim and the Galil were increasingly cut off. Convoys were frequently attacked and their riders murdered. An atmosphere of siege permeated the Holy Land. Meanwhile, in this environment, Ben-Gurion asserted his leadership even more than before. He's another fascinating personality. He'd outmaneuvered Chaim Weizmann and was now the head of the Jewish Agency executive. Ben-Gurion was born in Plans in 1886. He was drawn to socialism. He was arrested during the Russian Revolution of 1905, after which he made Aliyah, worked his way up the Zionist ranks. In some ways, he was a great realist. Ben-Gurion always assumed that the Arabs would fight the Jews for the land. He was tough. He was unassuming. He was informal. Even his wife called him Ben-Gurion, not David or Dave. And he was single-minded in his devotion to the Jewish state. He was tireless in his efforts on behalf of the Jewish state, tireless in his crusades against his personal enemies, which were many, and in the rightness of his views. He didn't tolerate other views very well. His religious connections, as we know, were very tenuous. He loved Tanakh. wasn't such a maimin. Apparently he never married his wife, Bechupa Bekidushin. He even flirted with Buddhism later in his life. One of the enigmas that religious Jews wrestled with was how could such a person so distant from Torah, play a critical role in reestablishing Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel? It was an issue then, to many it's an issue today as well. Rav Aviner was asked this just last week in a text question. How can it be, Megaldolin Schus Aidei Zakai, that good things come, reward comes through good people, not through bad people? So Harav answered, obviously then, he was a Zakai. If the Schus came to him, through him, obviously there are things about him that we don't know. Above all, Ben-Gurion was a powerful leader, and it's hard to imagine a leader less powerful succeeding like he did on the conditions he faced. By 1948, as I mentioned, Ben-Gurion had become responsible for defense as well, increased weapons development, smuggling. The Jews used Prague as their conduit. He mandated universal conscription for men and women, and yes, even Haredim trained and fought in 1948. The Jews benefited, in fact, from the multiple Arab armies that were waging war, that often refused to cooperate with each other and were often bitter rivals as well. So in March and April, there were repeated battles along the Yerushalayim Highway, with temporary victories allowing supplies in temporarily, followed by losses and reimposition of the Arab siege. So in that context, the battle for Deir Yassin that we discussed last week took place just weeks after the bitter fighting at Castel, just up the hill from Deir Yassin. You see the monument along the highway still. Many monuments adorn the highway. The fighting was fierce for months. Although a handful of villages, Jewish villages, were abandoned, generally Ben-Gurion ordered a fight to the last man strategy. And the literature of the times recalls the heart-rending pleas of Jews in these beleaguered communities for help, for weapons, for manpower, only to be told none would be forthcoming. They would have to fight with what they had as long as they had. And even so, in late April, Haifa was secured. In early May, Tzfat was captured, both benefiting from the residual fears generated by the Deir Yassin massacre story, inflamed by both Arabs and Jews, each for their own purposes. But 100,000 Arabs had already fled by March 1948, long before Deir Yassin. Many more would flee during the course of the fighting. Yaffa was liberated on May 14th by the Irgun, a fateful day in many respects. That entire week, the week of independence, a fierce struggle was being waged in Gush Etzion, which had been awarded to the Arabs under the partition plan. And the fighting was bitter across the country. As the day for the British departure neared, the situation in Gush Etzion became very grave. Meanwhile, the dire situation on the ground, insecurity, hunger, fear, was matched by the diplomatic developments that threatened to destabilize the situation by the day. After the U.S. abandoned the trusteeship idea, the State Department hit on another plan, supposedly out of humanitarian concerns, a simple postponement of statehood in order to keep the peace and avoid all-out war. It was Dean Rusk who brought this news to the Zionist establishment in America, and Rusk convinced one of the more controversial and outspoken Zionist leaders to go along, that being Nachum Goldman. Goldman would become a leading advocate of the no declaration of independence, become a thorn in Ben-Gurion's side. He would lash out at Ben-Gurion for bringing an unnecessary war on the Jewish people, and he'd go on to become a gadfly, a peacenik, a nudnik, an accommodationist as the head of the World Jewish Congress. Ben-Gurion sent a message to Rusk. No, there would be no delay. And in fact, if you look historically, every time Israel has defied the Americans, it's worked out well. In 1948, in 1967 when they went to war, in 1981 when they bombed the Iraqi reactor, all against American over American pressure and against American advice. And conversely, when Israel caves to American pressure, invariably it does not turn out well. Ben-Gurion said there would be no delay. Moshe Shertak, later Moshe Sharet, first foreign minister, second prime minister of Israel, flew to Washington to meet George Marshall. Marshall also told Sharet to delay independence, that if they declared statehood, a war would break out in which they'd be annihilated, and that the United States would not send troops to defend the Jews. Nor, he said, despite Truman's commitment, nor would the U.S. recognize a state that would be established through a unilateral declaration. And he warned Sharet, I want to tell you as a military man, don't rely on your military advisors. You cannot survive a prolonged invasion. In fact, the CIA report from 1947 had stated that the Arabs would win and that the Jews, at most, would be able to hold out for 2 years. By the way, that same CIA had also just reported that the Soviet Union would not be able to produce an atomic weapon until the 1990s at the earliest. So, they're not always right. Sharet, personally wavering, responded directly. The Yishuv would not commit suicide to gain the friendship of others. America's a friend, but they're not going to do nothing and lose this opportunity in order to keep a friend, even the United States. He did inform Marshall in confidence that they had made overtures to King Abdullah of Transjordan, and they were hopeful that he would stay out of the war. Before Sharet returned to Israel, he spoke to Weizmann, who was still in New York, who inspired him, in fact even yelled at him, don't let them discourage you. Either the state is established now, or God forbid, it will never be established. For when Sharet returned to Israel to brief the Central Committee of Mapai, he first met Ben-Gurion. He gave him his report, and he said that Marshall is right. They would not win, they would lose American support, and postponement would be better. Ben-Gurion urged him, said a different way, he threatened him. He said, if you don't want to ruin your life, this is in one of the biographies of Ben-Gurion, the authorized biography, if you don't want to ruin your life, you'll give your report to the Central Committee, but you'll leave out that part about Marshall being right. In fact, indeed, in his report, Sharet recommended statehood despite all the opposition. And he deflated the opponents, who were already numerous, who were counting on his gravitas to persuade others. Some religious Jews were also anti-Atzmut. I mentioned last week as well. Not just the Natura Karta, but even the Brisker Rav, among others, adamantly opposed the state and the Declaration of Independence on grounds of Pikuach Nefesh. And the thinking was simple. They just lost so many millions of Jews. Give it some time. Otherwise, we know a war is coming. Give it time and let's see what happens. Meanwhile, in April, the U.S. had called for a 3-month ceasefire, and they continued to pressure the Jews not to declare statehood. On Wednesday, May 12th, remember the British are leaving Friday night, May 15th at midnight, the Provisional Council, Minhelet Ha'am, met in Tel Aviv to decide, to deliberate what should be done 2 days hence when the British mandate would end. As the meeting began, Golda Meir passed Ben-Gurion a note. She was the one who had been tasked with persuading King Abdullah to stay out of the war, and she failed. Abdullah claiming that after Deir Yassin, he had no choice but to join the war. Of course, he had another interest as well, territory, control of Yerushalayim. The fact is, no one was interested in creating an Arab-Palestinian state, not even the Arabs who lived there. That desire would not be fabricated for another 25 years. Meir's note that she passed to Ben-Gurion read simply, there will be war. And Ben-Gurion understood it was because Abdullah had refused. In fact, Abdullah, already May 12th, had begun to mobilize the Arab Legion, and they were poised to attack. Ben-Gurion, though, did not share this information with the others on the council. Yigael Yadin, who's the head of the Haganah, was called in to report on the prospects for the war to come. He answered, Hachansim Shkulim. I didn't realize Chansim was a word back then also. Apparently it was. Hachansim Shkulim. It's a 50-50 proposition. Those are the odds he gave the Central Committee. Privately, he felt the Arabs had a considerable advantage. Ben-Gurion, though, knew that within 2 days of statehood, there would be a massive influx of weapons already en route from Czechoslovakia, and then people as well, the refugees, many of whom would be pressed into battle almost immediately. The council deliberations were very tense, lasting from 1:45 p.m. until midnight, Wednesday, May 12, 1948. It's a long meeting. The 6 million Jews murdered in the Holocaust weighed heavily on everyone, pro and con. Pro-independence, they felt it would be a legacy, vindication for the Jewish people. Others just feared more destruction. Some on the council wanted a truce to buy time, a premature declaration, followed by a defeat, which was very possible, could jeopardize everything they'd worked for 50 years already. A defeat would show the world that the Jews were not yet ready for a state. And in fact, the Haganah was not ready. The Palmach had not been incorporated, so independent fighting unit. Ben-Gurion had just unilaterally fired Yisrael Galili, who was the Palmach's representative on the council, because the Palmach was drawn largely from Mapam, and they were rivals to Ben-Gurion's Mapai, so he just got rid of them. But under pressure, he was reinstated, in fighting as well. Indeed, just as an aside, one of Ben-Gurion's greatest accomplishments was ultimately exercising civilian control over the military. The truth is, the Irgun HaMelechi almost immediately offered to join the Haganah. The Palmach was resistant for months until Ben-Gurion imposed his will on them. Of course, as the Altalena episode we discussed last time proved, it was not necessarily done peacefully or properly, this integration. At present, we're now May 1948, there are only 20,000 Jewish soldiers that were battle-tested and ready. A quarter of them had fought in World War II, but they would be vastly outnumbered by the Arab fighters, and they also staggered across the country. There were 3 brigades in the whole north, less than 10,000 soldiers, only 2 brigades south of Tel Aviv, only 1 Yerushalayim. There was no air force to speak of, no navy, few heavy weapons. All those would come only after independence. The Provisional Council was also a limited group, basically Mapai, Mapam, and the Mizrahi. The other groups were beyond the pale. Ben-Gurion, vengeful to the end, refused to allow any representatives of the revisionists or the communists, whom he despised as well, on the Minhelet HaAm. Begin and his supporters were allowed no vote and no voice, although from hiding, Begin called for an immediate declaration of independence. So on this position, he was on the same page as Ben-Gurion. Of the 13 members of the council, only 10 showed up. 3 were rabbis on the original council, including one that Ben-Gurion had flown in from Yerushalayim, because he knew he was a yes vote. One other was stranded in Yerushalayim, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Maimon of Mizrahi, a Talmud of the Aruch HaShulchan, and another was in New York, Yitzhak Meir Levin of Agudat Yisrael. As the meeting dragged on Wednesday, May 12th, Weizmann in New York grew more frantic by the hour, sending at one point a telegram, "What are they waiting for, the idiots?" Before midnight, the vote was taken. On the question of whether the council should accept Marshall's offer of a truce or declare independence, 6 voted for statehood. Ben-Gurion, Chaim Moshe Shapir Mizrahi, the one he had flown in from Yerushalayim, Moshe Sharet, Peretz Bernstein, and 2 Mapamniks. 4 voted against: Eliezer Kaplan, David Remez of Mapai, Pinchas Rosen, and Bechor Shalom Shitrit, who was the Sephardic representative. It was a close vote. If one vote of the yeas had turned to nay, it's a tie. By a vote of 6-4, independence would be declared 2 days later. Since nothing great is supposed to come easy, the Declaration of Independence was also controversial. The British were leaving on May 15th, which of course was Shabbos. And such a formal declaration had to take place before Shabbos. It's May 14th, Friday, Heiyar Tashach. On Wednesday already, after the vote, late Wednesday, they began to draft the text of the declaration with many hands involved. Everyone trying to get a word in or a word out, having been down this road with Jewish organizations more than a dozen times, I could tell you it's torture. It's frustrating. Everybody wants to have a say, and when it's voted, it still changed. I'm surprised it took 2 days and not 2 weeks. There were 2 points of controversy. One was the suggestion that the Declaration of Independence define the borders of the new state by the UN partition plan. Those the state's borders, what the UN granted them in partition. Ben Gurion was against that very strongly. He said, if the Arabs start a war and we conquer more land than was allotted to us by the UN, why should we commit ourselves in advance that it's not our land? The proposal to include borders was defeated by a vote of 5-4. So too, as you heard, how and if the declaration should mention God provoked a heated debate. Rabbis Maimon and Shapiro wanted a reference Elokei Yisrael, Kel Yisrael the Goalo, which was anathema to the atheist Mapam. It was Ben Gurion who suggested Tzur Yisrael, Rock of Israel, saying each can interpret it as you wish. God, like in the Tefillah, or what's the Rock of Israel? The land. The land is filled with rocks. And he did something else as well. He pleaded they not put that phrase to a vote. And in fact, his plea was honored by one Mapamnik very grudgingly. On Wednesday, they also discussed what the new state's name would be. It was not as obvious as we think. The first choice they had been debating for months already was Tzion. Makes sense. There was Zion. Tzionim. Tzion. Eretz Tzion Yerushalayim. There are other possibilities raised. Siona, Yehuda, Judea, also makes sense. Ivria, land of the Hebrews. Herzliya, to honor Herzl. It was Ben-Gurion who, in an inspired moment, suggested Yisrael, and that was adopted unanimously. It just sounded perfect to everyone. Meanwhile, in Washington, Truman favored recognition of the Jewish state, but Marshall was adamant that the Jewish state not be recognized by the American government, telling Truman, in fact, that if Truman recognized the Jewish state, remember, 48 was an election year, Marshall would not only publicly announce his opposition to Truman for re-election, but he would personally vote against Truman for president. Clifford urged immediate recognition, saying that statehood was inevitable, and the Soviets would gain if they recognized the Jewish state first. Marshall objected furiously. I've also heard these things at meetings of lesser significance. Why is Clifford here entirely? He's a political advisor. He's not politics, he's diplomacy. He shouldn't even be here. On May 12th, the same day the council voted for independence, Truman decided to defer to Marshall and to delay recognition. Next day, Thursday, Under Secretary of State Robert Lovett called Clifford to say that, on second thought, Clifford was right. And Weizmann, too, that week appealed directly to Truman for recognition. Lovett intervened with Marshall, and Marshall relented to de facto recognition after a few days. Truman heard this, he was ecstatic, he called Clifford in, and Clifford said to him, a few days, why wait? He immediately called Israel's mission to get a formal request for recognition. The final text of the Megillat Atzmut was agreed upon only 3 p.m. Friday afternoon. With the ceremony planned for 4 p.m., the declaration was rushed over from the J&F building where it was typed. Zev Scherf, who was Ben-Gurion's secretary, had to flag down a passing car to take him to the ceremony. En route, they were stopped for speeding. And it's hard to imagine they had police stopping people for speeding then. They don't do it today either. They only avoided a summons when they explained the purpose of their mission. Scherf arrived at the Tel Aviv Museum on Sderot Rothschild at 3:59 p.m. At precisely 4 p.m., Ben-Gurion gaveled the meeting to order. Spontaneously, the 250 people assembled rose and sang Hatikvah, as you saw, in front of the picture of Herzl, flanked by two Zionist flags. Ben-Gurion read the Megillat Atzmut, Be'eretz Yisrael, come, Ha'am HaYehudi. In the land of Israel, the Jewish people arose. Which in fact, I spoke in yeshiva in Israel last year, is not true. The Jewish people did not arise in the land of Israel. We rose in the land of Egypt and at Sinai, but nonetheless, that was Zionist ideology. And Ben Gurion, the Megillah traced the history of the Jewish people, the Churban, the Golos, the Holocaust, and continued, Anu Machrizim Bezot al Hakamat Medina Yehudit Be'eretz Yisrael, He Medinat Yisrael. We declare, we proclaim the founding of a Jewish state in the land of Israel. It will be the state of Israel. For the first time, people knew what the name of their state would be. Independence would take effect at midnight in Israel, 6 p.m. Washington time, en route to the White House, Friday afternoon, with a letter of recognition. The drafter, Eliyahu Eilat, who became Israel's first ambassador to the U.N., crossed out Jewish state. I have a copy of it here. Truman's letter was typed up, given to him to sign. It said, this government has been informed that a Jewish state has been proclaimed in Palestine and recognition has been requested by the provisional government thereof. The United States recognizes the provisional government as a de facto authority of the, and the original typing said, of the new Jewish state. Because they didn't know the name. En route to the White House, he found out the name, and they wrote him by hand, State of Israel. And that was the name. Joy erupted in Israel, lasted through the night. Zev Scherf said, the days of Mashiach had come, an end to Shibud Malchiyot. And Ben-Gurion again said, I feel like an Ovel at a Simcha. That same Friday, May 14th, Yom Ha'atzmut, Gush Etzion fell. 15 of its fighters were lined up and shot in cold blood, the rest taken captive. If you look at that famous front page of the Jerusalem Post, the Palestine Post, State of Israel declared, you look right in the middle, it says, Gush Etzion fighters taken POW, off to Jordan, to Beit Lechem as well. That Friday, at 6:11 p.m., the clip was wrong. It wasn't 11 minutes after his speech, because again, independence didn't take effect till midnight. Midnight in Israel was 6 p.m. in Washington. At 6:11, that Truman signed, he recorded the time, 6:11 p.m., formally announced recognition of Israel de facto. The Soviets announced their recognition of Israel just a few minutes later, de jure, meaning as a matter of law, as a matter of legal right, not just as a matter of fact. The next week, Weizmann met Truman, thanked him for support and his faith, and asked them for a loan of $100 million for economic assistance. That would be the first schnar, would not be the last, and Truman agreed. That Shabbos morning, the next day, Egyptian aircraft bombed Tel Aviv. Ben-Gurion had to be whisked to safety at his wife's prodding, and the war began. On Motzai Shabbos, Ben-Gurion emerged from hiding, and he addressed the nation on radio, the first public speech he had given in 5 years. And he called for a government based on justice that would encourage Kibbutz Goliot, ingathering of all the exiles. And he added, the Irgun Tzvayi Umi is leaving the underground within the boundaries of the independent Hebrew state. We arose in the underground under the rule of oppression. Now we have Hebrew rule in part of our homeland. In this part, there is no need for a Hebrew underground. In the state of Israel, we shall be soldiers and builders. We shall respect its government, for it is our government. And Gurion was not as magnanimous. That he did not reciprocate cannot obscure the fact that at this moment, at this time, he was indispensable in founding the Jewish state. It required a steely will and enormous courage, and it was his finest hour and a dramatic change in the fortunes of the Jewish people. I thank you all very much. We're off next week. We resume in 2 weeks. We'll look at the great debate, the reparations debate of the early 1950s. I thank you all again.